Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Hello, friends. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Thank you for joining us for this program, another episode in the series in which we are analyzing the arguments being presented to the Supreme Court in the Dobbs abortion case. As you know, if you've been following these programs, the court is considering the very basic and very important question as to whether or not the states can protect babies in the womb prior to viability. And this is a core question in the entire debate over abortion that has been raging in the courts for the last 50 years. Well, today we're going to look at a brief that was submitted by Professor Maureen Condick and the Charlotte Lozier Institute, a key pro-life research organization. Served by its president, a longtime ally in this battle and friend, Chuck Donovan. Chuck, welcome to the program. Thank you for making time for us today.
Well, thank you for doing this series, Father. It's a pleasure to be on.
And of course, for our listeners and viewers to know a little more about you, you've served in many distinguished circles. Now, of course, as we mentioned, at the Charlotte Lozier Institute, but you have helped at National Right to Life Committee. You've helped lead the Family Research Council, the Heritage Foundation, and not to fail to mention, with President Ronald Reagan himself, working for him during his administration. So thanks for all the service that you've given to the movement, the cause, and the nation. And it's just always a pleasure to connect with you in various ways as we get to do along the way. Tell our viewers about what Charlotte Lozier Institute is.
Well, Father, we're 10 years old. We were founded by the Susan B. Anthony List as it's part of its education fund a decade ago. And what we realized was that the Guttmacher Institute, American College of OB-GYNs, had a lot of firepower devoted to research, to data, to science, to statistics. And our side didn't have anything quite as robust. We had University Faculty for Life, a lot of distinguished scholars. But we didn't have any organization systematically encouraging those scholars, underwriting their work in many cases, but also primarily bringing it to bear in the courts and before legislatures. We wanted to change that.
Well, you have done so. And, you know, I always say to my staff, you know, we never can skimp on research. We never are never devoting too much time for research because it undergirds everything else that our movement does. So we want to thank you for this work. So this brief, I think this is really fantastic. Let me just summarize it in my own words. And then I want to ask you to help us delve into it more deeply. That the problem we've been dealing with the way the courts have been treating abortion is that they're saying to the states, yeah, you know, you can regulate it in various ways, but whatever interests you're pursuing as a state, they really aren't strong enough before viability to allow you to actually protect these babies, actually prohibit abortion. What this brief is saying is because of scientific research that helps us to know now that the baby in the womb is able to experience both consciousness and suffering far earlier and far more intensely than we knew before, because of this new research, we're arguing to the court that, well, you know, the interest of the state in protecting living beings from suffering is compelling enough indeed before viability to allow the state to actually prohibit abortion and protect these babies. Is that in a nutshell what this brief is laying out?
Well, you pretty much have written a summary of the argument, and it's outstanding. The only thing I would add is that this isn't in the nature of the history of Roe v. Wade. It was researched. It was debated before the court. They couldn't reach a conclusion. They postponed the decision back in the early 70s. They sent Blackmun out to the Mayo Clinic to do research. But that was really all that was the input the court had in terms of current science. And to be truthful, current science in the early 1970s about the unborn Ultrasound had not been put in general application. Certainly the general public hadn't seen ultrasound images. Knowledge of the unborn gained by that imagery and other scientific means, all of that is new. And in fact, the court in 1973 received very few legal briefs arguing science. So what we have is a radical difference now where the 80 pro-life briefs, 80, Father, have been submitted to the Supreme Court. Ours is one of the most scientifically oriented, but others are dealing in statistics and the fact that women now serve in great numbers in legislatures, many of them pro-life. They're capable of debating and having quality outcomes on these decisions. So we're bringing to the court scientific information the Roe v. Wade court simply didn't have.
You know, when I think of Roe v. Wade, Chuck, I think of it as being defective in at least four ways, four major ways. It's defective morally, obviously. It's defective constitutionally. It's defective historically. And fourth, to the point of in this brief, it's very defective scientifically and medically. Because Blackmun, as you say, I mean, even though he tried to say, well, at this, you know, the quote, at this point in the development of man's knowledge, we can't speculate as to when human life begins. I mean, even in 1973, that was a ridiculous thing to say because he actually, and you know, our friend Dr. Tom Hilgers wrote a book recently about fake science and Roe v. Wade. He said Blackmun literally ignored, just passed over, skipped as if it didn't exist, hundreds of years of scientific research about the beginnings of human life and the reality of the child in the womb. Now, this brief catches us up, not only over that gap that Blackmun ignored, but even right on time, I mean, it brings us practically up to the minute. I mean, if the brief is saying, oh, well, you know, just this year, this happened and that came out. And I mean, it brings us literally right up to the minute. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Maureen Condict, whom I also know, I've had the privilege of interviewing her in the past. But tell us a little bit about her and what she brings to the table in this brief.
Well, she's unique. She's a fabulous scholar. She's rigorous. She's been at this a long time, 20 years as a professor of neurobiology at the University of Utah. She has taught embryology, and her legal brief amasses all of the citations about the changing identification of the what is called more or less the moral relevance of pain in the unborn child at the beginning of the second trimester. So we're talking even before the Mississippi law limits abortion at 15 weeks. And what she shows is that the neurocircuitry is in place for that experience of pain, same standard that would be applied to a newborn child or a toddler, that the condition of the baby is such that that circuitry should register pain. We cannot directly measure the consciousness of pain, of course, but we can show that the baby reacts in the way that other human beings and even animals react when confronted with a stimulus that would be offensive or painful to the child. So she advances that argument. We think it's strongly probative, and she makes other arguments. I would say emphatically that what we have now is an advance of scientific arguments and realities, including surgery on the unborn, possibility for stem cell transfusions, observations of babies that show that twins in utero react differently around each other. They may move in vigorous ways, but when they move toward each other, there's a gentle, you could call it a gentle regard. There's just so much going on there, but I don't think we've discovered a single thing since 1973 that doesn't reinforce the humanity of the unborn. And it's, we are the ones who need to be rehumanized to recognize that and act on it.
Isn't that true? Yeah, we don't dehumanize the unborn without dehumanizing ourselves. It's true. And Maureen has pointed out, I mean, this brief talks about, you made reference to it there, that we're not only talking about the pain that the unborn can feel. Right. And of course, the brief references the fact that that pain may in fact be more intense than what we would feel under similar stimuli, because the pain inhibitors come later after the pain receptors. But this social interaction is fascinating. Like you mentioned about the twins, that she actually uses the word discernment. She uses it's almost like almost like a decision making. The baby realizes there's another baby here when there are twins, and the movements, the way the child interacts, are actually distinguishably different. This is amazing stuff, and so the science is there. The science is developing. Let's talk on the issue of pain. I mean, and I know that some of our viewers have read some of the articles or seen some of the other interviews about fetal pain and all the evidence that's been amassed on that. Chuck, one of the longstanding arguments here is that has led some researchers to say, well, the baby doesn't feel pain until much, much closer to birth. Right. Is this idea of the cortex, the highest part of the brain, if you will, and that the cortex is necessary to be present and functioning and connected before somebody can be aware of pain. Now, this brief summarizes what some other researchers have also said. It's like, wait a second. We've got a lot of evidence that in both in babies and in the animal world as well, pain is experienced well before the cortex is actually present or developing, and that it's more the thalamus, that part of the brain that develops first, the thalamus, that is responsible for the experience of pain. And she quotes one researcher who just this year, apparently, changed his position about this. Used to say that, I think his name is Derbyshire, that he said, he used to say, oh yeah, the cortex is needed for pain, and now has abandoned that position, which means then, really, she puts it, doesn't she, like between 12 and 18 weeks now, that we can say that this baby is experiencing pain, which, as you said, is right there, even earlier than where Mississippi has placed its protection of the unborn.
Right. Well, you begin with the premise that the presumption should be that you have to absolutely exclude an experience of pain. You know, I worked for President Reagan, and he always said in the abortion context, if you came across a body in the woods and you weren't sure if it was dead or alive, you wouldn't bury it. That'd be the initial thing that you wouldn't do. But you're right about Stuart Derbyshire, who's a researcher whose writing about 15 years ago helped persuade the American College of OB-GYNs, who are not pro-life, that they could exclude the possibility of pain, that if it does occur, it's going to be later in pregnancy after viability in terms of its relevance to this Mississippi case. But he's now amended his view, and he co-wrote an article with an outstanding young writer named John Bachman. We've talked to he's not quite a doctor yet, but will be, John Bachman, and they put together a journal article for the Journal of Medical Ethics. It's in the British Medical Journal, so they're not off in the woods. And they say they've concluded, based on this very kind of finding, that the cortex is not necessarily needed for an experience of pain. They place pain earlier in pregnancy, which Maureen relies upon, and they think it's morally significant. One's pro-choice, Derbyshire is still pro-choice, John Bachman's pro-life, but it's become something we can agree on and should agree on, because the presumption that there's pain is the only humane thing that we should be doing.
Now, for those that are just joining us, we are talking with Chuck Donovan of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, a pro-life research body that is really serving the movement in many ways, among which is a very powerful brief submitted to the Supreme Court in this current Dobbs case. So, Chuck, we've seen the development of the science. Evidence is there in this brief and, of course, mountains of it elsewhere as well. Let's explore how this then impacts the legal argument. As we briefly summarized at the beginning, you know, the courts have been, and I thought that the district court in Mississippi just treated the state so in such a shabby and really offensive way. And they simply, it was like they put their hands over their ears and their eyes to any kind of evidence, including the scientific evidence, and said, listen, we don't even want to hear what the state has to say about why they want to protect these babies, because they're trying to protect them before viability. And because it's before viability, that case closed, you know, they throw out the law. And this, of course, is the very question now that the Supreme Court is reconsidering. Lead us into the legal argument here, because what's happening here is the state is essentially saying, listen, we have reason now for the court to give more weight to our interests. In the state has various interests, of course. One of them is to protect this life. And isn't this brief make particularly the case that there's a specific interest here in protecting living beings from suffering and pain? So establishing the scientific developments, we say, wait, there's a legal interest in protecting these babies from pain, and therefore the courts need to change the boundary line here as to when the state can actually say, we prohibit the killing of this child.
Well, the good news is that's squarely the question that the court has framed for itself in taking the Mississippi case: are all pre-viability limitations on abortion unconstitutional? So in a sense, that's the starting point. But you have to bear in mind that in the Casey decision, while the court didn't change the jurisprudence of abortion, it basically set up a new standard of an undue burden. And then about 15 years later, the court came back in the partial birth abortion cases, and after originally striking down Nebraska's pro-life law, they upheld the congressional statute. And this is where it got interesting, because Justice Kennedy, who helped basically reenact Roe v. Wade, if you will, they acknowledged in that case that partial birth abortion was so atrocious, the mechanics of destroying the child while it was partially delivered, suctioning out the baby's brains, those things could actually be without medical justification and also disparage and degrade the reputation of the medical profession. Well, what's an interest besides the life of the baby? What we've got that's exciting here is that on top of viability having moved 4 weeks since Roe v. Wade, you have all these other things going on. As I say, the science is very clear on the separate humanity of the child. And these interests now, it appears to us, can be weighed. And the question is, will the court allow all pre-viability limits on abortion? Or are they going to take a one-step-by-one-step approach? We're hoping the court will realize the court is not designed for weighing science, medicine, harms, and so forth. People can do this work, and it's time that the court let them get back to doing it.
Right, because if they were to put like a different boundary line, let's say, okay, we're not going to say viability, let's say 12 weeks, or aren't they still legislating in that case? I mean, who are they to put a boundary line in the first place? There's nothing in the Constitution about any of this. And there's nothing in, as many of the other briefs point out, there's nothing in the deeply rooted in the history or the legal practices or traditions of our country to justify any of this either. I mean, let the states legislate. That would be the best outcome here, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be. It's exactly right. Texas's heartbeat law, for example, focuses on heartbeat as a dividing line where jurisprudence can protect the unborn child. The other side has started to try to dispute that there's a heartbeat. Having said that, they did stop doing abortions because they can tell when a heartbeat is there, when every medical textbook, OB-GYN textbook has said that for decades. I think what's most exciting here is that basically the American people are sending this signal time and again, that there's another basis, another interest for protecting the life of the unborn. I would certainly draw to conception, and a number of the amicus briefs ask the court not only to reverse Roe, but to affirm that the life of the child is constitutionally protected Ronald Reagan used to say that. He said he believed that the Constitution already protects the unborn. It was the Roe v. Wade court that attempted to revolutionize our understanding. But having said that, as I say, everything that we're learning in the area of science does more to tell us that's a human being in the womb, has unique characteristics, has unique abilities. We're just beginning to understand that 15-week baby doesn't like noise and does like music and will recognize the sound of the mother's voice. We encourage women to talk to the child in utero. There's a lot more going on there than just a mass of tissue would suggest.
You know, Chuck, towards the end of the brief, there's a very important point made, and this came up in the whole partial birth abortion debate, as you know, that I want our viewers to understand, and it's this. We will hear people on the other side say, oh, well, this state passed this law or the Congress passed this law because of the science, okay, and this brief deals heavily in the science. Right. But then they'll try to say, oh, but not all scientists agree with this or that, whatever the point might be, whether it's about the pain or the consciousness of the child or whatever. They'll say, oh, but some scientists disagree. And then they'll start to trot out, you know, their own experts and their own research. Well, the point they're trying to make is, as long as the scientists agree, as long as we can line up our experts against yours, the state should stay out of it. The law shouldn't say anything, that there can be no legislation. And the court has made it clear, and this brief emphasizes the point again, that just because there's scientific disagreement, that doesn't mean the state cannot legislate. Can you comment on that point?
Well, you know, abortion has been described as a super right in the sense that the standards that apply to balancing other rights where there's a rational interest on the part of the state, maybe an uncertain effect or two. That standard is not applied in the abortion context. But to take for the example of wearing a seatbelt, states require the wearing of seatbelts, not because it never happens that someone was harmed by a seatbelt. It can happen. And scientists may disagree about the degree of harm, but on balance, the science is very clear that wearing a seatbelt is hugely protective. Same thing with airbags and other things can actually do harm in some contexts. But those debates are held, judgments are made, refinements in policy are made. I think pro-lifers will be tweaking public policy as well. There are things we disagree about, for example, baby boxes in the safe haven context. But those aspects of disagreement are exactly what legislators are for. They're not what Supreme Court judges applying principles devised in 1973 or promoted by the population control industry. They're not the only participants in the debate. And I think personally that a lot of the bitterness in American society is because courts have tried to relieve us of our requirement as concerned citizens to debate issues, resolve them, and come back again if we're dissatisfied. That's one of the reasons why we're so bitter. We've been stripped of our citizenship rights to make arguments and have good results.
Exactly. Well, this has been a great conversation. Chuck, thanks so much for this work. How can people contact the Charlotte Lozier Institute?
Well, we have our phone number, 202-223-8073, or you can find us at Lozier, L-O-Z-I-E-R, institute.org. Send us an email. We answer very specific research questions for anyone who inquires.
Yes, well, we appreciate that work on behalf of the whole pro-life movement. Friends, I want to urge you to take advantage of that. Chuck Donovan, Charlotte Lozier Institute, thanks so much for being with us today. Enlightening conversation. And we'll look forward to seeing you in Washington.
It's an honor. Thank you.
And friends, remember, SupremeCourtVictory.com is a special website we've set up with a prayer for victory in this case, and also with the links to all these different briefs, including the one that we've discussed today, and with a link to all these video interviews. Please take the time to both read and listen to that website, and also spread it to others. SupremeCourtVictory.com. Well, friends, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I'm Father Frank Pavone, Director of Priests for Life, and we will talk with you soon. God bless.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.